This is our last class studying the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I want to explore something that isn't often talked about, which is the absence of overt sexuality in Lord of the Rings. In fact, Tolkien wrote a lot of erotic material, but most of it didn't find its way into the finished text. Today, I want to read you some of the elf poetry he wrote.
Excuse me, Mr. Harris?
Yeah, what is it?
Are you sure this is a good idea? I mean, we're just ninth graders, and I, for one, you know, I really treasure some of the innocence in Tolkien's work.
Look, I know what I'm doing. I'm the teacher, right? Okay. This is written by an elf, maybe Legolas. It's titled, To My Coy Elf Mistress. Because I am an elf, I have three, and I live forever. So when I, you, it's going to be like the cracks of doom. I'm so glad I'm not a hobbit with a little tiny because you and I need so I can.
Mr. Harris.
What is it now?
This is upsetting me. I don't really want to think about elves doing this.
You make me sick. Your generation and your trigger warnings and your safe spaces and your self-infantilization, that's not going to cut it in the real world where elves are getting down and dirty and doing the nasty.
Mr. Harris, elves, they don't really exist in the real world.
They don't?
No.
Okay then, well, class dismissed.
Today on the Nose, Chinese dancing grannies, English teachers, and frat boys all in a world of trouble. And now he wants to read Harry Potter's homoerotic ode to Dumbledore, Colin McEnroe.
And I want to read it to you. All right, so we will be talking a little bit later about a poem that maybe never should have, but maybe should have been read aloud in class in South Windsor, in lots of other ways that people got in trouble, some of them teachers, some of them students. But we thought we would begin. Well, first of all, I'm going to introduce the panel to you, but we're also going to begin. We thought we would begin with the least familiar story. Like, you kind of know these other stories. People get in trouble, and then they try to get out of trouble, and there's kind of an American pathway that they journey on. So we thought we would begin by telling you a story that you don't know as well, because it's from a different culture and where things are handled differently. So we're going to tell you the story of the Dancing Grannies, which I think maybe you may not know. But first of all, let's begin with introducing the panel. So she's from the Mark Twain House, where she does something incredibly important. She will someday be a Taiwanese-American dancing granny. She's already laying the groundwork. She's Tracy Wu Fastenberg. And, of course, the musician and producer most beloved by the dancing grannies of China, Jim Chapdelaine. And she's got the dancing part down. The granny part will come as well. She'll never be Chinese. Irene Papoulis from Trinity College. So that's who's here today. And let me tell you, let me set the stage a little bit for you. So as the New York Times wrote this week, the offenders usually emerge at dusk, occupying prime real estate in public plazas or parks as they sashay to treacly Chinese pop tunes with their synchronized dance moves. In recent years, these cardigan-clad packs of, quote, dancing grannies, as they are known, have descended on tranquil neighborhoods across the city, occasionally provoking virulent responses from local residents who object to their amplified music. In 2013, a Beijing man seeking to chase off retirees dancing near his home was arrested after he fired a shotgun in the air and set three Tibetan mastiffs on the group. That same year, in the city of Wuhan, angry neighbors dumped feces from the upper floors of a building onto a troop of gray-haired women below. So the story goes on to tell what the government has tried to do about these adorable dancing grannies. They're not all women, and they're not all grandmotherly age, but that's you look at it, it's the preponderant demographic for this. So Irene Papoulis was the one who seized upon this and very early on said that it should be the focus of some of our attentions. Tell us why that is. What intrigued you about this?
All right. Well, a couple of things. The first one is just the image of – I love the idea of women, especially older women, going outside in their cardigans and dancing joyfully in the street, you know. And one of them was wearing, as the New York Times said, a blue spangled spandex top, you know. And they said it's better than sitting home watching TV. You know, what's not to like about that, about all these, you know, these women doing that and being fit, and it keeps them fit and it's great for their health, et cetera. And then I was interested in the reaction, you know, first of all, the you know, throwing feces at people, that's pretty extreme, you know, that people were so against it. And so the government's response is not to say you can't do it, you know, not to sort of ban it, but they didn't like it. So they decided that you can only do these 12. We're going to give you 12 particular dances that you can do, and you can only do those 12 dances. And each dance has to be taught to you by a certified instructor, you know. So I thought that's just such an interesting, first of all, the idea that dancing is somehow a threat to the system, which actually reminded me, if anyone remembers, I have to say as a parenthesis, Alan Bloom's book from, it was probably the 80s, The Closing of the American Mind. Everybody read it, and it was a big thing. And he had a chapter in there about rock and roll, about how that people didn't talk about as much as I wanted them to at the time, but it was about how rock and roll dancing is basically the end of civilization, because people get into these wild herds and they have like this sort of spiritual, you know, experience, and it's really it's a real threat to the culture. And so I thought that somehow the idea that unregulated dancing is a threat to culture, I find really interesting. And yeah, okay.
Which he
yeah.
said that reminded me of. I thought she was going to say Footloose.
I was going to say Footloose too. Yeah, yeah, the Chinese Footloose.
I didn't see Alan Bloom coming.
Alan Bloom plays Kevin Bacon, right?
Right. Sure. Well, you know, he's 3 degrees from Kevin.
Right.
But he really thinks it's threatening, you know, and I think it is. You know, it's sort of true. Even though I love dancing, I understand that it is. It can be a threat because it's kind of out of control and exciting. To me, that's a good thing. But to people in control, that could really be a bad thing.
The only time it's really a threat is when you're playing a wedding and there's copious amounts of alcohol being served.
So Tracy Wu Fastenberg, you get to say things like this, but so one of your responses was, that's so Chinese. When you're talking specifically about the government's response to this.
Yes, I'm talking about it's so Chinese, it's so mainland China, because if you think about the way that China's sort of controlled its culture over the years, it's been, we're going to prescribe things for you. You know, you can be an artist, but here's the art you're going to do. You can be an athlete, but here's the sport you're going to be good at. And so we're not going to tell you can't dance, but we're going to tell you how to dance and who can teach you and where you can do it and probably at some point what the appropriate costume is. And I should say that my grandparents left mainland China when the communists took over. They were more of the nationalist persuasion, so I may be a bit biased here. But it just seems so – what else would you expect?
You know, and I think it's interesting, the idea of commodification, you know, because Marx talked about commodification, that you take something that isn't for sale and make it for sale, you know. So dancing isn't for sale, but they're not necessarily making it for sale, though I don't know how they train the instructors, but they're making it. So it's like power. It's not for financial necessarily use, but it's for the exercise of power to control exactly how people dance.
Well, yeah, and if we're going to invoke Alan Bloom, you should invoke Theodore Roszak. Isn't he the one who talked about how, you know, any things tend to get co-opted, the things that people are kind of doing on their own get sucked in to the culture. So, you know, Jim Chatterley, one thing that I was also thinking is, ultimately, though, what the government's really doing is kind of harnessing this, right? I mean, this is something that people like to do. They like to dance. So rather than crushing it, the government, I think they may be kind of clever in a way, saying, well, we certainly are not going to tell you not to dance, but you're doing the wrong dances. Yeah. You have to do the dance. We've got a bunch better dances for you. Yeah.
There's an Arthur Murray over there making a bundle of money. I am speaking about a week before my daughter departs for China, and I would like for her to return. So I think whatever the Chinese government is doing is totally appropriate. But I do find it interesting that the backlash of this is basically the response that the grannies have had, and they've sort of rebelled as much as they can in a really funny way by basically becoming kids from the 1960s. They've reenacted, they don army clothing, and they reenact scenes to nostalgic war movies where they capture the bad guys, meaning the Germans and the Japanese, and they play music too loud. So those are the things we did as kids and that our parents yelled at us for doing, is playing with guns and playing music too loud. So somewhere now their kids are yelling at them for – doing the things that you're
and they're our age, you know, they're the baby boomers.
Right, right.
What actually was really surprising to me is that, you know, it's such a culture. The Chinese culture is very much based on respecting your elders.
Well, exactly.
So yeah, reading, you know, that people were dumping feces on these mainly.
Well, just once.
Just that one time.
Yeah. And that's a new form of respect.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So I had not heard about that. So, you know, it's all okay. But it just threw me that this culture that's steeped in, you know, respecting your elders, this piety has sort of turned on them in this way because they're just way too subversive with their dancing.
Exactly. Or you respect your elders until they run out in the street and start dancing.
So, to me also, the parallel track about all this, or the thing that I really started thinking about it, and I did put it on the show page at WNPR.org too, is that one thing that's going on – I mean, where else do people feel overly regimented and oppressed? American public schools.
Or Zumba class.
Right. But one thing that's going on a lot in American public schools these days, and there's one, I put one up that's from the A. Maceo Smith New Technical School. It's a school either in or near Dallas, Texas. But you've seen this before. You see it all the time now, where students and faculty do this kind of flash mob style dancing. This is to Uptown Funk. They're not especially good, but there's something there, you know, but they're being led by a teacher, and it's everybody sort of out in the halls doing this dance. And you realize that it's a tremendously effective way of building spirit and letting people kind of cut loose in this very Dionysian way.
It's also a brain break, which is a very fashionable kind of way of giving your brain a 2 or 3 minute rest during the day.
Yeah, but that one was more than two. You know, that one, they had it so well organized and choreographed and everything. So that was like a giant brain break, you know. Which
you'll notice that my comments today on this subject are going to be very vanilla until this trip is over.
He doesn't want to give anybody any material. Okay. So, just to make a segue here. So what we're seeing, dancing is, first of all, I should say, I have about 10 methods of processing reality. And I just try to kind of, you know, space them out on these episodes so it's not obvious that I only have 10. So one of the ways that I look at reality is Dionysian versus Apollonian. So Dionysian obviously favors chaos, favors impulse, favors disorganization, favors creativity. Apollonian is much more about organization, structure, order, and you sort of need both intention to have a civilization. So obviously, but anyway, in China you see this Dionysian activity of dancing, and as much of an Apollonian framework as can be put on it is being put on it. I mean, they're pretty Apollonian in their style of dancing to begin with.
They're not really whirling dervishes out there. Nobody's shaking their
booty.
They're
not grinding or anything.
There's no bootylicious stuff happening.
They are not crazed minads.
But I think that is why it's threatening. It's because of the idea that it's Dionysian, you know. And I think it's – I'm always – surprised at how threatening that is.
Well, so, you know, wait till they get to the Chinese twerking. That's just a matter of time, right? Twerking grannies.
So let's make the jump from the dancing grannies to another sort of Dionysian versus Apollonian moment. And that happened in a school in South Windsor. It involved a poem by Allen Ginsberg. Not probably the poem by Allen Ginsberg that you know best. This poem is called Please Master. An English teacher at South Windsor High School. I believe this poem is actually brought in by a student who was suggesting that it be read in class, and
that's
he thought
different.
About it. Yeah, he thought.
That's a new slant for me.
I believe it was brought in by a student. I think I read that somewhere. But anyway, he decided that he would read this poem aloud in class, and it got him in so much trouble that his career is kind of dangling by a thread. I think he has been suspended. There was a piece in the paper today that they're still trying to figure out what to do about this. One of our other fellow regular Nose panelists, Rand Cooper, called my attention to this, and he said, you know, it's one of those things where he and his wife were reading about it, and they were getting outraged. Somebody's reading a poem by a great poet like Allen Ginsberg, and they're getting suspended. What is this, 1952? This is nuts, you know. And then they read the poem, and it was like, maybe we still think that, but we don't think it quite as vehemently as we did before. Because when you read the poem, it really is. We are not going to read any of the poem to you. I'll just begin by saying that. We are not going to.
You can find it online.
Right, you can find it online. You can find it on your own. It is a very homoerotic description of by one man saying what he wants another man to do to him. And well, no, to him, I think, as opposed to with him, really. But anyway.
Do we know – I know this is an AP class, but do we know – What age? What grade?
Well, it's a high school class. It's an AP class. I mean, you know,
probably seniors.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can fairly safely assume junior seniors. But I don't know. Well, first of all, let's go. We should say that the teacher who's gotten in all this trouble, I believe, is a graduate of Trinity College, though he did not necessarily take Irene's class in themes in Allen Ginsberg's poetry.
But he took dancing.
He did take dancing. And so I don't know. Did you have that reaction? I mean, you're a believer in literature and
Dionysian
and Dionysian
philosophy. When I first read the poem, I thought, wow, I would have trouble teaching this poem. But then I started to, because it's very graphic, I mean, it's very explicit about, every line begins with, please, master, do this. And it's, you know, there's something that seems pornographic about it, you know, just in the sense that it's written to sort of titillate the reader or whatever. But then as I thought more about it, I thought, well, you know, if you read it in the context of somebody who's gay, who's writing in a world in the 50s where, you know, a lot of the acts he describes are illegal, you know, there's a plaintiveness about every line starting with please, master, and the whole poem is basically about the other guy's pleasure, like, just do all this stuff to me so that you'll be really turned on. And that's, you know, there's something, it becomes more of a beautiful poem. And I thought, you know, maybe it is just cowardly of me to think, oh no, I don't want to bring that into the classroom, especially since, you know, students, it's not like they've never heard of this stuff. It's not like they can't go online and actually see people doing that stuff. So if it's going to get them excited about writing and reading, why not?
It's going to get them excited about something.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, just before I go to the other panelists, let me ask you to put on a different hat. So not too long ago, your son was a high school student. So I don't know.
I thought, wow, what if he brought that home and that was the poem that he was reading in class? And yeah, you know, I think I would be a little bit uncomfortable about it, but I would have to. It would be, I think, perhaps a productive kind of discomfort.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I like a productive kind of discomfort.
Sure.
But, she makes it. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I can't believe Irene was dancing while she gave that answer, which I think is great. I read the poem, too, and I have to say I was initially disquieted. It was like 50 shades of whoa. And it's definitely sort of full circle because I know high school students are seeing 50 shades of gray. Mm-hmm. And there's an aspect of that in there. However, would my daughter, should she bring this home and read it, I might not be uncomfortable. Were she to ask me to help her process it, I might be a little uncomfortable, but I'd probably address it. But I have to say it's slightly disquieting.
Well, you know, I mean, as the youngest person here, we should she's not responsible for the activities and attitudes of the generation that's in high school and college right now. But I did notice in some of the articles that I read about this, Tracy, that another thing that happened was that students said that they were upset. A few students said this was upsetting, which is, I think, kind of a thing that happens now. You know, I mean, I'm upset. That upset me.
But
I don't.
A student brought it in. That's
right.
A very interesting twist for
that
me.
Was,
but
that
what
was
a teaching moment to be able to learn about, you know, what about it upset you? Why are you upset? And how do you deal with that? You know, how do we kind of talk about it? How do we have that conversation? Not just in the classroom, but at home with your parents. You know, what about this, you know, made you uncomfortable? Were you made uncomfortable? Did you not understand it? You know, talk about it. I'm not saying that my parents would have had that conversation with me. They absolutely would not have. But at the same time, I think when students say that they're upset about something, it's a place to be able to talk about that, not just say, oh, no, then we won't make you upset. We won't make you uncomfortable. I'm so sorry. We'll punish the teacher. It's okay, so let's figure it out.
So you would come down pro teaching it in a high school class?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah,
I would. I'm not saying that I would have been completely comfortable with it in high school myself, because I was a very, very innocent high schooler. And so some of this, frankly, might have needed to be explained a bit more to me at that point. But to have that conversation, have the conversation about why it was important in its time frame and what path it paved for future literature.
There is the tension between the world as I would like it to be and the world as it is. And so in the world as I would like it to be, that poem could be taught, that poem could be read, kind of on the spur of the moment by a teacher who's feeling at the spur of the moment, yes, this is a good idea. The student brought this in. I'm going to read this poem and not have to run it by some kind of faculty committee, which would absolutely 100% tell them no anyway, and that things would work themselves out. But the reality is that, I mean, this once again is sort of Dionysian impulses surfacing in what's supposed to be a pretty Apollonian environment, the public school system. The public school system has all kinds of rules and codes and regimentation. It's different from a private liberal arts college. There are a lot of different stakeholders. And there is this kind of latent fear among a certain segment of the American public that one of the things that's going on in the public school system is they're going to teach your kids how to be gay and there's nothing you can do about it. They're just going to do that.
So is it that, what if it had been a woman in the poem? You know, I mean, what exactly is the objection that people have to it?
I don't know the answer to that. But I'm guessing the homoerotic nature of it. I mean, I'm guessing those kinds of – that kind of language involving a man and woman would have – excited a certain amount of perturbation, but maybe not quite as much as the fact that it's a man talking about what he wants a man to do to him.
Okay, that's interesting, because that didn't even occur to me when I read it, because I was just thinking of that sort of explicit sexuality of it.
Mm-hmm. But I also think, you know, we're in Connecticut, which is a pretty liberal, you know, environment for that, and the fact that it stirred a little dust up here. Imagine if that guy was in Texas and read that.
Yeah, but isn't – but that's literature, you know? I mean, you can't just say we're going to teach literature in a – yeah, but I mean, I think it's
– I think the key thing is the discomfort in learning how to – I'm punching the table here while I gesticulate. That's antihistamines, baby. I think the discomfort is good for everybody, you know?
I mean, I come from the Twain House, where a lot of what we discuss is – whether or not Huck Finn should be taught in schools. That's another piece of literature that's part of our history. It's a great American novel that is, you know, for most part for young folks to read. And it stirred up so much controversy over the years. But it's something that, you know, I land, of course, on the side that it should be taught to kids, even though, you know, there is language in it that may make you uncomfortable and that we don't accept now. But back then it was acceptable. It was part of the history.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that students have so much like access to all kinds of material online. You know, they can see anything. They can see any brutality, explicit sex, anything. But at the same time, we seem to want to have more of a narrow, you know, sort of scope about what happens in school. And there's really a problem there because the students, you know, they're not really protected from anything, even if they're protected in school. In a way, it just makes school less appealing.
And you're not teaching them how to process the things that they are being exposed
exactly.
to outside of school.
I think also, you know, Jim was saying this is happening in Connecticut. And I think what this also kind of exposes a little bit is the way in which I'm trying to think of a way to – I didn't really think this through carefully, so I want to phrase it the right way. But, you know, we in Connecticut and a lot of other states, we, for very good reasons, are saluting a different set of principles these days, and particularly the idea of gay marriage. And gay marriage has been, in fact – and we see these wonderful, happy scenes in city halls all over the country where gay men and gay women can get married and can enjoy some of the all of the franchises and benefits that heterosexual people have. And I think it's one thing to be comfortable with that, and it's another thing to be comfortable with such a vivid description of what gay people do together. And in some ways, I think one of the things the South Windsor thing kind of pries apart a little bit is this. I mean, and it's not confined to literature class, right? If we're going to be cool about this, we're going to be cool about gay people, and we're going to be cool about gay people getting married, which I want us to be, then we have to, when we teach sex ed, we have to teach how to have safe gay sex. We can't just teach heterosexual sex. We've got to make it clear what gay sex is and how to do it as safely as possible and treat it in sex ed classes the way we treat heterosexual sex. And some parents who might say, oh, yeah, I really like Ellen DeGeneres, will flip out if their kids are being taught how to have safe gay sex.
You know, I think this would have been probably different, even more different, if this was a poem about two women, which for some reason none of us seem quite as offended by. Or the general culture doesn't seem as offended by that. Young men are routinely exposed to that. And I think, again, discomfort is good. And what you're saying about educating people fully is good. And the more that I hear you guys talk about it, the more I'm like, yeah, let's go for it.
Well, I'm sure the teacher in South Windsor hopes that our pleas reach the ears of the gods. But anyway, I think he's going to have some nervous weeks ahead of him. We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more of The Nose after this. Welcome back to The Nose, our Friday Cultural Roundtable. Joining us today, Tracy Wu Fastenberg from the Mark Twain House, musician and producer extraordinaire Jim Chapdelaine, and professor of Ginsberg and other topics at Trinity College, Irene Papoulis. Although you're not a professor of anything right now, right? You're on a sabbatical. You're thinking big
thoughts.
That's right. All right. So if you have any big thoughts, email them to Irene, not to me. Speaking of what goes on in colleges, everything came to a halt, writes the Day of New London, on the Khan College campus on Wednesday afternoon as President Catherine Bergeron canceled all other events and called for a campus-wide forum to address a tenured professor's Facebook post comparing Gazan Palestinians to, quote, a rabid pit bull chained in a cage, regularly making mass efforts to escape. Gaza is in the cage because of its repeated efforts to destroy Israel and Jews. Andrew Pessin, a professor in the, of philosophy at the college, published on his personal Facebook page in August. It took a while for this to kind of filter out somehow. The blockade is not a cause of the current conflict. It is the result of the conflict. It cannot retroactively become its cause. Anyone who fails to recognize that clear and obvious fact is demanding the release of a rabid pit bull. And so this stirred up the all I have to do is talk about something. Yeah, actually, that won't work. My iPad's dying, so somebody's here trying to help me charge it. But it's the wrong – it doesn't fit. It won't – it's like this kind of thing. And I don't need my iPad anyway. It's like Yoda telling you to turn off the computer and use the Force. I'm going to use the Force. Right, exactly. So where was I? Okay, so this campus is in an uproar. The campus is in an uproar because of this. And once again, we have people saying, that was troubling to me, that was offensive to me. The professor himself has taken he's troubled now. He's taken a medical leave because he's freaked out and so stressed out by all the stress that other people are expressing to him that he has to go take his medical leave. So he went home to Providence and his bathroom exploded. That's like, I don't know why I'm the only person. That's literally true.
Nobody responded to that when you shared that information.
His bathroom exploded. This man's bathroom exploded. And I am the only person who thinks, I mean, if I were him, I would think, well, maybe the Palestinians blew up my bathroom. I mean, they hate me that much.
Really, really, really bad week.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, like, his bathroom really exploded, too, and, like, people had to flee the building and there were fire trucks and stuff
exploded.
Like that.
Wow.
Made the news exploded.
Well, I think if there's anything more inflammatory than talking about explicit gay sex, it's talking about Israel versus Palestine. You know, I mean, it's just such a trigger for so many people on each side. It's so very, very hard to talk about the issue in a way that is reasoned because people have such emotional, intense emotional feelings on each side.
But the question is whether he had a right to express his emotional opinion or not. And I think he does. I think it's his personal Facebook page. Yes, he's a professor. Yes, he's at a college, but at the same time, this is something that affects him personally. So he's allowed to have whatever opinion that he wants. And I actually didn't think that was – I would not consider what he said hate speech, though. There's a lot worse things that people have said on both sides of this.
It's certainly not flattering.
No.
And it's definitely opinionated, but he's definitely entitled to it. I don't see how you – what the blowback is about a person posting their personal views on their personal page.
But would a racist view be the same? Would you say the same?
I'd say we would be talking about it.
Well,
I'm not condoning either. I'm not taking a position on it. I just would say he has a right to say what he wants to say.
So here's the tripwire that I think is being kicked here. First of all, one of the things that he has subsequently said is he was really specifically talking about Hamas. This was part of a longer exchange. He wasn't saying all Palestinians are pit bulls. He was saying Hamas is metaphorically a pit bull. But the tripwire that's being kicked, I think, is Palestinians are dogs. And so the argument that's being made is that's a dehumanization. And it's a specific – I mean, I don't really know sort of Middle East rhetoric well enough to be sure of what I'm talking about. But I feel like that's – I mean, one of the ways that this argument does sort of play out is like people who are rabidly anti – I guess I use my own dog metaphor. Yeah. But people who are fervently anti-Palestinian, we'll sort of talk about them that way. They're like wild animals, you know. So that's part of the problem here. But I'm with Jim and with Tracy on this, that when I first read about this, I was bracing myself to read the actual Facebook post. And I read the actual Facebook post, and I thought it was sort of the opposite of reading the Ginsburg poem. I sort of thought, oh, well, that's really not that bad. But I also thought of the case of the Reverend Bruce Shipman, who was at Yale. He was a chaplain at Yale last year. He was quoted as – he wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times, I think, saying something that branded him as anti-Semitic. I mean, basically the gist of the letter was, yes, anti-Semitism is a problem in Europe. If you want to do something about it, one thing that you could do is that American sponsors and supporters of the Netanyahu regime could get them to dial down the violence against the Palestinians, and maybe some of the anti-Semitism would go away. And people freaked out about that. He lost his chaplaincy. He was forced to leave. And I thought at the time, that's wrong. It's wrong. And I think it's wrong if this guy, I mean, I wish he had was a little tougher, like he didn't take medical leave the minute the going got tough. But I think we have to, just to back to what you're saying, you're absolutely right. If you want to cause a firestorm on a college campus, just talk about this subject. But boy, if we can't do it any better than this, I mean, if people can't endure, you know, opinions that they don't like, we're never going to get anywhere.
I have to agree with that. But I also think that what he said was more offensive than maybe somebody who's outside the situation might see, you know, and that it is really worth being called attention to as something seriously offensive.
Yeah, I think that's
part and parcel of posting something like that, right? If you're going to post something that's on the edge of controversy, you're inviting controversy. It just took a long time for the controversy to find him, it sounds like.
But productive discomfort. That's the theme of the show, productive discomfort.
Right.
So that makes you uncomfortable. You know, it makes me uncomfortable. I mean, my sympathies tilt probably, you know, a bit more to the Palestinians at this moment. And so it makes me uncomfortable to have this professor saying that they're dogs or that they're like dogs or something like that. But, I mean, I don't mind having a conversation with that guy, asking him a few more questions about what he meant. He and Bruce Shipman should have a dialogue somewhere halfway between Khan College and Yale, have a little forum or something. But I just don't, you know, I just, it is that sort of thing. This thing upset me, so you have to leave.
Right. And it also gets back to our dancing grannies. I mean, you can say stuff, but we're going to tell you, here's 12 things that you could say.
Right. Everything goes back to the dancing grannies. Right.
Yeah, but there is some unproductive discomfort. You know, there is – sometimes you can forbid people from saying certain things, I think.
Yeah, well,
but
I guess
maybe
there's
a certain
–
or so say how, it a certain way.
Does this – it's probably racist what he said, right? So how far over that line is that for you?
But it's even probably racist. I mean, it's not definitely racist. I mean –
well, I think dog in that world is considered
– that's the problem. In that world, dog means
– that's a trigger word.
Yeah, it's a trigger word.
It is a racist –
but if you say Hamas is like an attack dog, I mean, I don't know that that's racist, you know.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. Yeah. And all right, so we're going to take everything that we've done so far and plug it into one last thing. So, and we're going to talk about somebody who has done something that is unquestionably racist. I mean, we can debate back and forth all this other stuff, sort of the gray area stuff, but obviously what happened at that Oklahoma University bus, the SAE fraternity, everybody knows that's racist, everybody knows that story. It's guys singing a horrible song about why there aren't any black members of their fraternity. It uses the N-word. It evokes lynching as a productive solution to this problem. I mean, it was just one of the most horrible things to watch in the world. So then one of the questions becomes, how, if you're one of the guys on that video, do you petition the human race to let you rejoin? This week, one of those guys, his name is Levi Pettit, appeared at a press conference. He was really surrounded by African-American community leaders whom he had reached out to and whom he had met with. He made a profound apology. He said, although I don't deserve it, I want to ask you for your forgiveness. I never thought of myself as a racist, but the bottom line is the words that were said in that chant were mean, hateful, and racist.
I never thought – how can you even say that with a straight face after saying what he said? And he was leading the cheer, right?
I think he was the ringleader.
Yeah, I think he may have been the ringleader.
And I think he's taking the heat because he was caught on film. But I don't get how you walk this back, and I see this. He's surrounded by a network of professional apologists who are orchestrating every single move he makes. And would he be apologizing for this if it was not on that little YouTube video?
If it hadn't caused
a firestorm. Well, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, that goes without saying. However, I think I see this differently than everybody else here, but I want to hear from everybody else here. What are your thoughts about this?
My thoughts were I first actually read it in the paper, the story of what he said, and then I watched the video. When I read in the paper, I was kind of on his side because I felt like he was really showing some, you know, I didn't know that I was racist, but now that I see that I am, is a really interesting move, I think. It's not just like, I'm not racist and I didn't mean anything. It's really trying to say maybe, I felt like, you know, maybe he was actually starting to think about things and understand that you can throw these comments out as a cheer in a group that you do all the time, but it really means something. So I was sympathetic to him when I read it. But then when I saw the video, I felt like, ugh. You know,
you mean the video of the chanting?
The video of him.
Talking.
Not the chanting, of him talking. I felt like he just had that look of like, yeah, I'm going to say I'm sorry, of course, because I know I have to.
I memorized the script.
I felt that it was a little different.
I'm not deviating
person.
From the script.
That,
right.
Yeah. See, now that bothered you for some reason. You
bothered
brought that
me
up.
Too.
That really bothered me. I think if you are sincerely apologetic and you really understood your wrongdoing, then you're going to be a little more candid in expressing that sorrow and apology. But he didn't go off his script. You know, he had the perfect visual going
right.
on.
Optics.
And you know, one of the lines from the New York Times said, you know, he deflected questions about where he learned the chant. You know, and he deflected a couple other questions, too. He declined to answer them. I feel like if you're really sorry, you're ready to have that conversation. You can say, you know, I don't want to get the person in trouble who taught me the chant, but it was handed down to me from another brother or whatever. You know, share a little bit about that. Answer in your own words, because for all we know, he memorized, was reading from something
no
that
doubt.
Was produced by somebody else. And so I have a hard time believing that he's sincere. I want to, because he's a young man, and I would think that as we go further into, you know, younger folks, my generation, that we've sort of moved past some of this racist stuff. Clearly we haven't. You know, we've all seen Ferguson. But you hope that, you know, our next generation coming up will be beyond that.
It's by the way, we have a minute or two extra to talk about this. If you want to call in at 860-275-7266, you have to do that right now, though. 860-275-7266, because we need time for our endorsements. I was a little bit different from the three of you in the sense that I sort of feel like we live in the society right now where people do get caught a lot doing these things, you know, and we all read this John Ronson article from the New Yorker, from the New York Times Sunday Magazine called How One Stupid Tweet Blew Up Justine Sacco's Life. It's a woman getting on a plane to go to Africa, and she makes a tweet that's really stupid, almost implying that she hopes she doesn't get AIDS, but then because she was white, she won't. She felt like it was a bad joke. She lost her job. She lost everything. By the time she got to Africa, she was like this famous person on Twitter, and her own family was saying, "We can't be with you. You know, you're too horrible. We can't be with you." And the Ronson article mapped out a whole bunch of other people who, in similar ways, have just screwed up so badly that they've lost jobs, that they've, like, you know, haven't left their house for a year. You know, it's like that. And if we're going to have that kind of culture, it's like you have to have a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. I think you need a path to citizenship or human race. For people are going to do these things. And either we're going to keep them as permanent social lepers, you know, for the foreseeable future, or we're going to have to kind of almost work out social code saying, here's what – yeah. So I thought this guy, at least he went and faced some African-American people, you know. And no, she's just – it doesn't cut any – cuts no ice with her.
They're distinctly different events. One is if you read her Twitter feed, she has a bunch of pretty lame jokes. And this is an attempt at a lame joke.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at him chanting these overtly racist, hateful things and leading the pack – it just, to me, his apology fell in line with this whole series of American apologies going back to Jimmy Swaggart or or Anthony Weiner, where it's carefully orchestrated, it's theatrical, it's designed to have some sort of impact, and then they go on.
But does he have another, you know, is there any, like, what if he really did feel remorse? In a way, he would have said, like, so I sort of feel like time will tell. We can't tell now, but it'll be interesting to see, to follow his case and to see, is he really going to, you know, act on his newfound understanding of racism, or is he just going to go back to being a regular, you know, go to another school and be the same frat boy at another school? I don't know. But so in a way, we can't tell, because what could you say?
I would just love to hear those sort of back channel phone calls. Dad, you won't believe what happened. Can you call yeah. Uncle Bernie, the lawyer, and get a PR firm together really quick?
Yeah, but I mean, I do think it's good in response to what Colin said before, you know, that's one really good thing about the internet, I would say, in the sense that people have always said racist things to each other behind closed doors. And just nothing has happened and nothing has changed as a result of it. And now it's very, very, very almost impossible to get away with that. And even, you know, down to the cameras on the police cars where the police are doing these horrible things, you know, that's a good thing, because we have to talk about it. We don't have a choice.
Discomfort.
This is discomfort. I'm not sure it's productive this time. But I mean, well, the thing where people get caught, that part's
productive. Some are and some aren't. Yeah.
So let's talk to Joe in West Hartford. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. I don't want to get too involved in the conversation, but I do want to point out that NPR has a show called Snap Judgment, where there was a black man who took it upon himself to establish dialogue with a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. I believe it was Maryland or that area of the country, and sat down with this guy and established so much dialogue over the course of time that he actually got him to hang up his robe and renounce his ways. And if you could turn a leader of the Ku Klux Klan back on his own opinions, you know, this kid who obviously made the wrong decision can be helped as well. I'm not saying we should open up our arms and just say, let's welcome everybody who's racist back to society, but, you know, people can be saved if they want to be.
The other thing about this, we've got some really interesting calls coming in, and I'm really apologetic, but in order to get to endorsements, we're going to have to stop. The Ronson article we read, at one point it looked back at Puritan times, at colonial times, and how people were punished. And one thing that I was thinking is, if you were lucky enough not to be executed, say, in Connecticut in the 1600s because you had a baby that looked too much like a pig or something, which somebody was, in fact, they were executed for that. But if you were lucky enough not to be...
Why do you know that?
I just know it. It's because the implication, the pig looked so much like the baby. I think each one of them had like a defective eye or something. And anyway, the implication was that this woman had...
Witchcraft or something?
Yeah, that somehow or other it was
bestiality.
Was the
father.
Yeah.
It was the father.
It was like that.
So, that's another poem.
Right. Yeah, so anyway... if you were lucky enough not to be executed for something like that, you could be flogged. And it's almost like, well, if you were put in stocks and whipped, or something, at least it was over at some point.
Right.
It was like, okay, we whipped you, go back to work.
Well, he's on probation now. He's on sort of societal probation. He has to sort of walk the walk.
But yeah, I sort of feel like...
And then welcome back. Do you just...
Yeah, I have faith that he can get there. I'm just not sure he's there and sincere yet. And right. I think, the
actual
time will tell
act is
truth.
What I rejected, the yes. actual yes. apology itself.
All right. Quick comment from Marcia, and then we really do have to run. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, Colin. I read something in the New York Times, and it could have been from a while ago. Monica Lewinsky was talking at a TED Talk, and she said to the people, raise your hand if you don't regret something that you did at age 22. Mm-hmm. While I don't certainly condone anything this kid did, I think some of you are being kind of hard on him, and he is a kid. You know, when you go into the courts, they think differently about younger people. You know, their brains aren't always ready to be thinking. So that's it.
All right. Thanks for your call. We're going to leave it there. If you have other comments, you can email me, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org.
Shame on you. Shame, shame on you. Shame, shame on you.
When this show is over, I'm going to hit the clubs and dance like a Chinese granny. Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kion Wolf. Our interns today are Kelsey Bissell and Sydney Lauro. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bruno Mars. For show pages, articles, and videos of a Faith Middleton Show flash mob dancing to Peaches and Herb, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday's show, only the Scramble knows what's on its mind. And now, back to Colin.
A special props to Greg Hill, who's been coming in here like a NASCAR pit crew trying to save me from my dying iPad. But you know what? What I've got now, everything I need to know is on a Post-it. Probably everything I do know is on a Post-it. Anyway, very quickly, with 5 minutes left or so, let's do some endorsements. Irene Papoulis, what have you got?
Okay, I have two books. I'm really interested in repressive regimes and repressive everything these days for some reason. Anyway, so I read a memoir called Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite by Suki Kim. She goes to North Korea to teach in a Christian school, and she talks about it gives you a window. She's not a great writer, but it gives you a really interesting window into North Korea. And then I'm also still in the middle of this book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which is a really wonderful book about how the development of Al-Qaeda and I learned something about ISIS in the process too, even though ISIS hasn't begun yet.
Lawrence Wright.
Thank you. 2006 he wrote it.
Yeah. All right, great. What have you got, Jim?
Well, nothing compared with that.
Well, she's on sabbatical. She's just reading.
I know. Okay, yeah. So I'm going to re-endorse Larry Wilmore on The Nightly Show because I like the way he's kind of taking that in a slightly different direction. This week, the emperor of all maladies, Ken Burns' sort of series on cancer is going to be shown, I believe, and I would recommend you watch that. And if you get a chance, the great writer Jimmy Webb is playing tonight at the Kate and I believe tomorrow at the Iron Horse. But he's a must-see. He's written some of the greatest songs ever written.
And I think I've seen what Jimmy's been doing lately, too, is coming and he'll sort of play, talk.
Right.
And he has very entertaining stories to tell. His story about driving around Ireland with Richard Harris, who, of course, sang MacArthur Park, a Jimmy Webb song, is worth the trip to the Kate all by itself. Tracy, what have you got?
Because I've eaten this three times this week. Bear's Smokehouse Barbecue. If you guys haven't made your way.
I still haven't been, no.
Make your way down there. They've got a location in downtown Hartford and one in Windsor. And I actually just had them cater an event for me at the Twain House, and it was amazing.
Was it just for you? They just catered this?
Actually, at the end, there were so many leftovers that I think it was just for me. But it's really fantastic, and I have to say, I don't even like barbecue. If somebody said, let's go for barbecue, I'd say, let's go for something, anything but that. But it's fantastic.
All right. So what have I got? Well, first of all, I want to recommend to you the Hartford Improv Festival, which is kind of organized by our friends at CT Improv. It's down at the Spotlight Movie Theaters. And improv groups from all over America, from the West Coast, from Charlotte, North Carolina, in from New York and down from Boston, they're all coming there and they're all kind of competing with one another. And I think you buy a ticket. You can buy sort of, you know, passes for the whole thing or whatever, or you can just buy a ticket for an hour of improv, which is going to be probably three different improv groups. So anyway, improv comedy is a lot of fun. If you've never tried it, go and watch. I want to remind you that David Edelstein, it's less than 2 weeks away. David Edelstein will be joining me on stage at Watkinson School, part of the Freshly Squeezed series. That's Wednesday, April 8th. Go to Watkinson.org or call Watkinson to get your tickets now for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. We usually have big panels and stuff like that, and I decided just David and I would sit there and argue about things. And then lastly, in honor of Allen Ginsberg and the problems at South Windsor High School, and I'll have to post this at WNPR.org on our show page, I think, because it's hard to find. On a website called, I always call it Berfois. I don't know if I'm even pronouncing the website right. Berfois. There's a poem called Growl by somebody named Philip Notre Dame, and he has taken Ginsberg's howl and updated it for sort of the post-2008, you know, kind of – it's all about sort of horrible Wall Street bankers and, you know, dreadful people who kind of wrecked the economy and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's a great thing to do. And our whole show page, there'll be videos of dancing grannies and all kinds of stuff. It'll all be up at WNPR.org. You can look for the tab that says shows. That'll drop down. You can find the Colin McEnroe show that way. We do encourage you to email me, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Thanks once again to Tracy Wu-Fastenberg, to Jim Chapdelaine, to Irene Papoulis. Will be back on Monday with a scramble. We know not what the scramble will be about.
It's cozy, like a Cracker Barrel. Yeah, we'll be laughing, talking, joking, talking about this and talking about that, and talk about everything as a matter of fact. Oh, yeah. Talk about Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, all the berry, Woodbury. they said that one, Avon Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I'm 117 years old, and I can still dance. Don't believe me? Just watch. I'm okay. It's a new dance. I do it on the floor.